Declare your independence with Ernest Hancock.
Believe me when I say we have a difficult time ahead of us. But if we are to be prepared for it, we must first shed our fear of it. I stand here without fear because I remember. I remember that I am here not because of the path that lies before me, but because of the path that lies behind me. I remember that for 100 years we have fought these machines. And after a century of war, I remember that which matters most. We are still here! Let us make them remember. We are not afraid!
What appears a relatively concerned. You know, a lot of the news were up here talking with old friends and having dinners and so on. And, of course, the questions start. And a lot of them, you know that James and I do shows. They are interested in the site. They see that we talk, and they wanted me to ask you a bunch of things. But that comes down to what's your next documentary? Looks like you're... He's doing a series on media, you know, and the influence that it has on us. But that's one thing that when I talk to people, I want to spend some time on this today because it really has had a big impact. Because a lot of stuff, it used to be, it was the Bible. You know, the biggest media everybody learned to read from and how they did whatever was, you know, the Bible. And then certainly the news and such. But I'm looking. Yeah, I'm hearing a sound. Are you?
I am.
I wonder what that's from. Well, I thought it might be the fan, but what we're going to be doing is what I wanted to talk to you is the evolution of the media and the influence of us. And they go, well, they can't change what I think about. And then they'll say something. And I go, but why are you thinking about that? You know, why do you even have an opinion on that subject? Why is that subject in your head? Somebody put it there, you know? So I'm really interested in what you have to say about the influences on our mind, what we're thinking about. Then they'll get the, you know, foreman, you know, how we should think about it. That's why I always raise my hand, go, am I allowed to not care? You know, I just want to know if I'm allowed to not care. That's the first thing. Yeah, you have to care, and you got to care this way. But the first thing is you have to care. Then they'll try and get you to convince you to care the way they want you to. So this input into what we are to discuss and what we should care about has been coming from all kinds of different vectors. Walk us through a lot of these and where we're at now and where we're going, since you're covering that now, James.
All right, where to start? I guess the first thing to do is to reference, to give the plug to Michael Parenti, who wrote the quote that I use, or that I at least cite in my mass media course that I'm offering now. About that very subject. He wrote, the media may not always be able to tell us what to think, but they are strikingly successful telling us what to think about. And that right. is a subtle distinction that is so important. It goes right to the heart of what this is, what I'm engaged in, what you're engaged in, what all of us are dealing with, whether we know it or not, which is the media's ability to shape not just, again, not what we think about a given issue, but that we think about a given issue. The fact that we are talking about this and not that, the fact that we are thinking about this and not that, the fact that we think about this or that in a certain way rather than in a different way. And that gets into sort of the philosophical roots of this, where Marshall McLuhan and others writing about understanding media, talking about one of the things about the printing press revolution that we don't tend to think about is that it really transformed the way the way that we think about and process the world. When people become literate and they start reading words, I'm not going to hit the cough button for you. Left and when you're doing the left and right scrolling and scanning through words, that comes with it a certain ordering of the mind that is not there in pre-literate or post-literate societies, oral society, oral cultures, and others. It starts to affect the way that you communicate with others as well as what you communicate about. And he and Marshall McLuhan often cites the example of Kennedy consorting with Khrushchev during the Cuban Missile Crisis and other things. Kennedy did, got the phone calls, but he wanted the transcript of the phone calls, the printout. Whereas coming from a more oral culture was fine with just talking on the telephone. And these might seem like silly or trivial distinctions, but they're incredibly important to the way that we understand and process the world. And as you say, getting us simply to think about this or that topic, or to think of it in these terms, is the game for all the marbles. And when people see and really start to digest the work that I'm doing on media right now, I think one of the takeaways they will take from this is that what the media has done most effectively is not simply to create these technologies for communication that can then be censored with the heavy fist. That is not the best way to control what people are thinking. No. You, rather than censorship, what you do is you control the technology of the printing press or the radio or the television or the internet, so that then you can shape that conversation quite directly by directing people's attention this way or that. That's what this is all about. And that's why I'm here doing what I do. And I imagine it's why you're here doing what you do.
You know, the biggest reason that it's out of self-defense. And, they had the movie, The Anarchist, on HBO, they got a series and they just had the second one. And at the end of Le Boutier Squared, Howard did a thing on the second one. And I haven't watched it. I watched the first one. It's about Anarchapoco, and I got a couple of quotes in there. The one they had in there, I generally go, uncovering the secrets and exposing the lies. I'm tired of being lied to, that thing. And I didn't think it was as bad as a lot of people. They want to depict anarchists as being okay. They're not the... the dreadlocks drum beating in the middle of the street people, but they still, whatever. And of course, it's going to be, all right, everybody's relearning the word anarchist to mean no rulers, which is, that's kind of taking, we got to redefine it again, or once again, poo-poo, anybody that would advocate for this kind of stuff. So they're into the second one. I think it's probably a 6-part series. I've seen this before. It was called Doomsday Preppers, And after a few years, there was one guy, his name was Chad Hudspeth, that had developed an aquaponics system that he got an infrared heater that heated this ABS plastics, rectangle, and then it vacuformed to make tanks, right? It was really cool the way he did it. It was just an automated kind of thing. He built his own machine. So he started selling at these aquaponic stores, for growing weed or whatever, these aquaponic setups. And he would set them up there, did them at schools, did them at, sponsored, our aquaponic, our aquadome and everything. And then Doomsday Preppers called him. And they go, yeah, we want you to come on. But the only way that they would have him on is if he built this fake bookcase that went to a cylinder that went down in the ground and then out to his backyard into a buried shipping container that then he would pop out at the back of his yard to get in his Jeep and bust through like a styrofoam fake block wall. That was the end of it. But he agreed to go through all the BS if he could get what he wanted to say about aquaponics. And they asked him why. Why are you doing this? And he goes, democide. And like, democide, what's that? It's, the government killing their own people. He goes, there's been more people killed by their own government than all the wars combined, kind of thing. So that was his payoff for the whole thing. That was the deal that he had made. Then they called me, and they wanted me, there's a new series they wanted to do. They wanted me to be a talk show host that would interview these guys, and we would talk, and then, of course, they would edit that. And then they go out and do whatever. And I have that Skype taped because it was a young woman in her late 20s or something wanting it. The same old that all these guys want. Look, I know what you want to do, and I'm not going to be able to help you. We need to, don't you think that, and yada, yada, yada. Then we had an exchange student from Finland came, and she visited and spent, you know, a week or so in Arizona. And she had gone around different places in the Southwest, and she's like, anybody in Utah, Idaho, you know, Colorado, they all wanted to show you their guns. Do you have guns? Oh, yeah, but that's not really the point. What she was looking at, the reason she got funded by her government, her university, to go and do this, like, film series in the Southwest of America was because they saw doomsday preppers as, you know, like a thing what they were trying to do. This is worldwide. They're trying to make people think of people that are preparing in America as something was wrong with them. Well, in Finland, all the things that they were doing, they go, well, yeah, you do that or you die in the winter. I mean, you know, they were like, well, of course, duh. So they went and she talked to all these people and she was thinking, yeah, they were the reasonable ones. It's something, a programming going on by the government. And when the National Geographic called me, it was some offshoot of National Geographic, they wanted to, you know, kind of poo-poo this, you know, anarchist, independent, you know, free state kind of mentality and wanted me to help. And I'm like, nah, you know, I can see what you guys are doing. All right, fine, we'll get somebody else. I guess they, you know, didn't do that idea. They'll do something else. It's all about the narrative. And they were building up all this stuff for years was building up to what's going on now. And I felt that certainly in the last year or two when COVID started, we could see it coming, but I feel the trigger has been pulled. Do you think it's been pulled, James? And if so, aimed at what?
I suppose it has. Actually, I want to comment on what you're saying there and with that whole story, because actually that's fascinating. And one of the things it brings to mind is Neil Postman, amusing ourselves to thinking about how, in a sense, it doesn't matter what you put on television. You can put absolutely anything on television. It will all come through the filter of television to essentially become just one big homogenous product, media product for people to consume. So you can put people on television talking about democide and the need for, you know, aquaponics and communities and whatever, and it's just another thing. And then you change the channel and you're into something else, or there's a commercial break. And it becomes, just by virtue of being in that medium, it becomes, the message is essentially, this is just another mindless entertainment distraction product. It'll be gone 5, 10, 15 minutes from now. Don't worry about it. Don't put your, you know, don't do anything about this. This is just images for to distract you for a while. And so in that sense, it really doesn't matter what you put on TV. It's all going to be TV. The flip side of that is that I think the realization that the communications technology, in some sense, has been the weapon throughout history. People being able to unite and connect and spread ideas to other people has been the thing that tyrants have feared. Sorry?
No, I'm sorry. I pushed the button to shut. I told Donna I need the fan back on me. I'm sweating.
Oh, sorry. that is the thing that tyrants have feared throughout history. That's why it's always about censorship and book burnings and whatever, is because they know that communications technology and people getting together to discuss ideas has always led to anti-authoritarian ideas. Because people fundamentally, I think, are not authoritarians. I think we've been indoctrinated and baptized into this system from birth, but they need to propagandize us constantly to believe that we need them, which we do not. And so I think the real battle has always been about the control of that technology. And that's why I think the most subtle and insidious form of using that technology is not to censor and to stop, you know, people burn books or whatever. It is to essentially consolidate control of extremely capital-intensive technologies in the hands of the people with the capital, like an HBO, so that they, or a Graphic, or whoever, they get to put on whoever they think, and they get to put it on in the way that they think will be best suited to propagandize their audiences. That's what this game is all about. And that's why, that is precisely why the dawning, the advent of the internet was potentially the most significant event since the printing press revolution. I don't think there's ever been a communication technology that has put that power in the hands of average everyday people in the quite that way since Gutenberg and the printing press. So I think that's, I mean, that's what the elite have been the elitists, I should say, have been freaking out about for a couple of decades now. Oh my God, you know, they're the riffraff are talking, and oh, now we have populism. You see, pre-internet, they could talk about democracy and it's all about giving people a say and blah, blah, blah. And now it's like, oh no, people are speaking and they have their say. Oh no, it's populism. We have to squash it. That's the real game that's going on right now. And unfortunately, I think not a lot of people have understood or really processed the historical moment that we're in. I am exceptionally keenly aware, sure you are, because I've lived it. This is my life. I am literally here as a podcaster speaking to millions of people occasionally around the world. How the hell did this happen? It is because of this remarkable revolution. It's this tiny window of possibility that is being closed on us right now. That, to me, is what this is about. And that's potentially part of the answer to your original question, pulling the trigger, what is it aimed at? What are they doing? Why now? I think there really has been this incredible foreshortening of events because of the internet revolution, which, yes, you can say the World Wide Web was meant to trap us and it's, you know, it's all a surveillance tool. Yes, there is that side to it, but there is the communication side to it, which has fostered this incredible flowering of information and knowledge. I wouldn't know 1/1000th of what I know today if it wasn't for that revolution. So that's, I think, what the real contest is about here. And that's why I think they're running to slam that barn door shut as quickly as they possibly can right now.
Okay, slamming the barn door shut, define that. In what way? What methods? To what end? You know, what do they think they're accomplishing? What's the backlash? What? Talk about the door slamming.
Yeah, well, I could just speak from my own personal experience. I'm no longer, well, I am on GooTube, I guess. They suddenly reinstated my backup channel without telling me. Oh, whatever, I'm never going to post it there again. But they took me off there, and my main channel was scrubbed, obviously. Millions, however many hundreds of millions of views, I can't remember, that I had on there, gone. Totally gone. 500,000 subscribers. My ability to reach out in that way to a general public is gone. And not just me, of course. Many, 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 many people in the alternative media space suffered the same fate or are now, you know, speaking in code and anything to, oh, please don't censor me,
Cornholio
YouTube. I'll
disease.
Censor myself. Yeah. You know, it's one of those things, again, because I lived it, I know the incredible revolution that took place, because I know 5-10 years ago, not only was I on YouTube and reaching all these people, but my videos were being recommended widely to lots of people. I know there's a lot of people who stumbled onto my work, and that was an organic thing that was happening because of the way they set up the system. It's like, okay, everyone can have a say. And I don't know to what extent they were ignorant of that, to what extent it was a trap to get people into the system or what have you, but at any rate, here I am. And all I know is I'm for real, and I, you know, I don't have any secret tricks or inside sources or anything. It's, this is the way it developed. And now we see them trying to censor and control the internet in any way possible. And the latest news I've heard coming out of the UK, they're now talking about truth scores on social media.
What?
That the main social media, big tech giants are now going to have to, or it's a proposed piece of legislation. They're going to
legislation?
Yeah, apparently there is a bill that has been proposed in UK Parliament that would, I forget the exact details, but somehow assign a truth score to what is being said on social media.
I think this is part of the UK teenager people. You know, when we were we did a show with them just last week, and we're getting them a lot of help. They're working on, you know, a lot of different things. But I didn't, because of this, like, it comes into effect, I think, in March. You know, of 23, and they're saying by March of 23, their Discord channel is going to be down. They're busting butt. They're doing IPFS. They're doing Start 9 Labs is doing a thing with their embassy. They got Cordal now that they're working with. So we're using them as a use case, and you know, to be able to upload websites.
Yeah.
Mike Swatek and I were just talking, and he's practicing. They can have up to 500 megabytes. Well, that doesn't do me any good, but, you know, I got like, I need like, you know, God, I mean, you know, or terabytes. But I think what's going to happen is they're going to start increasing their capacity as they develop further, where you can just put entire websites up there.
Yeah.
But it's going to be a deliberate. We're going to have some inconvenience, you know, for us doing it. It's going to be an inconvenient truth that we're going to have to suck it up and do it, you know. And so my thing has been here just of late, as we're up with, you know, visiting with, you know, a lot of friends. Like I have a dinner this weekend with some people that we haven't seen for a couple of years up here and so on. And his name is Klaus from Germany, you know. And he here's how it goes. He becomes a school board member, and they mandated masks, so it's going to be an interesting conversation, you know. But the a lot of the people, they want to know, wow, yeah, kind of you called it. And this is what basically how it comes down to. How did you know? You know, I'm like, you know, I don't know what philosophy they operate on, but it is based on acceptance, go along, get along, fear of missing out, something. There's something that drives so many people to comply. And a lot of your research and so on, there has to be a weapon that you've come across, or you have an explanation for or comment. You know, help us out, Mr. James Corbett.
How do they get people to comply?
Yeah, there's some desire. There's some weapon that they use for people to, well, their innate default reaction is to do what the shiny badge tells them. The white lab coat, the stethoscope around their neck. Four out of five doctors recommend this cigarette. Yeah. I mean, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
What is that?
Well, okay, let's not just... Because the tendency, I think, in alt media discussions about this is to just completely dismiss that as just, oh, they're all bootlickers and they're all stupid and we're the ones that question authority. It's much, much deeper than that. Because, first of all, there is such thing as legitimate authority, in that there are people who genuinely do know more about car mechanics than I do. I'm not a mechanic. I don't know. I don't know how this car works. I'm going to have to rely on someone to tell me how to fix this car or to fix it for me, because I don't know. So there is legitimate authority where there are people who know more about a subject. And so especially, and this is, so when we're teaching children, when we're growing up as children, most things in life are completely new to us and we don't know. And we have to, so we often, hopefully, if you have a nice family situation, you look to your parents for guidance and advice, and they tell you, and or they say, okay, well, you know, you should talk to this person about that, or we go here to get this, or that kind of thing. So we learn from the earliest age possible that, yes, we're, you know, obviously we need to rely on other people in order to understand things. And so we start to learn about authority and legitimate authority. Unfortunately, of course, then that gets wrapped in this kind of blanket statement. You know, your teacher will know the answer to this question. The policeman will help you if you're in a problem. You know, these kinds of general things, which, of course, are not true. And unfortunately, if they're drilled into you hard enough as a youngster, you will simply go along with that. The real discernment is in the ability to discern legitimate from illegitimate authority. And of course, as always, in our ability to reserve judgment for ourselves. Yet I get to decide whether I think this is legitimate authority or not, and whether I'll go along with
this or not.
You
know, I just saw your interview with Richard Grove talking about his autonomy thing, and that was a lot of what I see from his graduates and people that I've met that have taken his class, is that they have a new way of thinking. Hell, they're just thinking. I mean, oh my God, when was the last time you sat down and thought? And that right there used to be so commonplace and ubiquitous that it was never really considered as a skill to learn. And now it's become like a class you need to take. It's like a prerequisite to even go into school before you go to school. So when they talk about the tritium or
trivium.
Trivium. Explain that. Are you familiar with that, what they're talking
about? I am familiar. I'm not an acolyte of this being the way, the truth, and the light. But the logic, grammar, and rhetoric, and once you work out the grammar and the logic of something, then you can express it in rhetoric and blah, blah, blah. It's the old lost art of learning, blah, blah, blah. People can look up the wiki on it and start diving into it from there. But in that conversation that I had with Rich, I thought it was interesting. As someone pointed out in the comments, isn't it ironic, or I can't stop laughing at the irony of teaching about autodidacticism, like teaching how to learn for yourself. Isn't that kind of a contradiction? But you're right. I think, honestly, just the basic life skills of how to go about, okay, I have this problem. How am I going to start approaching how do I solve this? And who am I going to turn to? And what resources can I use? And how do I apply that in my life? Yeah, that is the kind of thing that we all should just know from our own experience, from growing up, from life. But no, we get taken out of any sort of natural process of learning about the world and put in to the school system, where you will listen to your teacher, you will train for the test, you will learn this way in this form from, you know, 8:40 a.m. until 9:20 a.m. you will learn about this subject, and then the bell will ring, you will walk to a different classroom, and now you will start learning about this subject, which of course is completely unnatural, has nothing to do with our natural ability to learn about the world. We have to be uneducated, as it were, from the education system. Yeah exactly.
You know,
in order to start learning how to learn, which again, you're right, it should be. And hopefully, to some extent, some of these concepts are already familiar to people, but no one's ever come along in your life and told you step by step, okay, this is how we're going to start it. You're going to start by defining the problem, and you're going to sort out what you need, and you're going to, and some people really need that, and can,
you know,
absolutely
benefit
from it.
I want to get this point in. I remember, I think it was like biology in my sophomore year in high school, and they had talked about when peak performance for young kids growing, certainly young teenagers and so on, and at the time, what was I, 14, 15 years old, and, you know, how much more sleep you needed, and, you know, you need to sleep later, and that we're having to get up at 6:30, 7 in the morning to go to school, and then you're freaking whipped, and you're tired, and then you got extracurricular sports, and you go to bed, and, you know, I was burning both ends and had a part-time job. So I'm just thinking, I go, why don't we start school a little later? I mean, 9:30 is cool. You know, we could be done by, most of the time you're going from class to lunch to jerking around and not doing anything. I mean, this is be way more productive. I could teach myself better. And then my junior year, I didn't take the class, but there was a class that was called Life Skills in History or something like that. And it was a 2 or 3 period class. So it was actually, you got immersed and you could go places and do things and field trips. And, you know, you learned about, you know, life and how to balance a checkbook and doing that. And I'm going, wow, that sounds cool. I got a lot of that at home, but a lot of it I didn't. And, you know, if I'd understood how much typing I was going to do, I would have took typing. But the at the time, I remember thinking, yeah, this is on somebody else's schedule. This is not conducive to learning. This is not for me. This is for something else, you know? And then you start to see that, you know, the administration. I remember one time I was in student council and so on, and our class, we had had the payphones back when there was payphones, you know? And the payphone money, they wanted us to give the school the money so that when, you know, district or supervisor or school people came or guests came, that it would pay for their lunch or something. I'm like, well, just give them a free lunch at the camp. What do we care? They wanted to take our money that we had, you know, used to raise for our class projects or whatever. And I'm thinking, who are these people to make these kinds of decisions? And what is and isn't important? And how early I got to be at class? And how long I got to learn about what the criteria and the requirements that they have of whatever? And then the electives aren't really what I want. And they got this community college thing that a lot of us started going to learn that, like I did vocational photography and so on. I never thought that school was optimized for us. And anything that they did was an appeasement to shut the parents up, you know, if they bitched about stuff. So when my kids started, and it got very clear to me that when my oldest, she was in third grade, I think, I go, and we're done. And we pulled them out of government schools and never went back. And I'm happy as hell. So this now, I'm thinking that certainly with the COVID thing and the lockdowns and the kids home, that there is, and you look at stats and it's doubled, tripled, quadrupled how many homeschoolers there are. But it's not about learning. Well, how are you going to learn this and that? Who says I'm even going to do that? Why would make you think I want to just duplicate what you did, morons? You know, we're gonna learn how to grow more than a tomato plant and a half pint milk carton. A good example. Here where we're at, the farm here, they have a nice office and, you know, has cubicles with internet access and so on for doing work and stuff, and people are visiting. And Don and I were in there doing some work, doing some paperwork and so on. And there is a young woman that has two little kids. The boy is 6 and she's like 8, I think. And she's in there working, and they're homeschooling. Well, when they get done, they go out to the garden. They're out in the garden, they're taking care of, just had a baby buffalo. They're doing, you know, blah, 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 blah. They're out. Which one do you think, I think, is the better education? You know, what's going to make them more of a rounded human being, able to survive, you know? So I don't think this system has our best interest at heart. What is their interests?
We don't even have to speculate about that. We can turn to what was said on the record back in the day about the education system training people to be better workers. And let's see if I don't have the reference off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure it was in my Big Oil documentary. So let's show people how to learn. CorbettReport.com/Big Oil. Now, if I remember correctly, Woodrow Wilson had something to say about this. So let me just do a control or command F. Search for Wilson, not Charles Wilson. Oh, no, okay. Education. Let's search for education. Da, 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 da. Ah, okay. The oligarchs needed a mass of obedient workers, an entire class of people whose intellect was developed just enough to prepare them for lives of drudgery in a factory. Into the midst, the Rockefeller with his first great act of public charity, the establishment of the University of Chicago. He was aided in this task by Frederick Taylor Gates, a Baptist minister that Rockefeller befriended in 1889, and he would go on to be John D.'s most trusted philanthropic advisor. Gates would go on to write a short tract, The Country School of Tomorrow, that laid out the Rockefeller plan for education. In our dream, we have limitless resources, and the people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hand. The present educational conventions fade from our minds, and, unhampered by tradition, we work our own goodwill upon a grateful and responsive folk. We shall not try to make these people or any of their children into philosophers or men of learning or science. We are not to raise up from among them authors, orators, poets, or men of letters. We shall not search for embryo great artists, painters, musicians, nor will we cherish even the humbler ambition to raise up from among them lawyers, doctors, preachers, politicians, statesmen, of whom we now have ample supply. No, dot, dot, dot. No, we need obedient workers for the factories that we're creating. We need to train these people how to be good
workers. Happy.
And remember, those are the exact points that John Taylor Gatto was making in his resignation letter and in the Underground History of American Education. Remember his resignation letter, I quit, I think, where he wrote, I just can't do it anymore. I can't train children to wait to be told what to do. I can't train people to drop what they are doing when a bell sounds. I can't persuade children to feel some justice in their class placement when there isn't any. And I can't persuade children to believe teachers have valuable secrets they can acquire by becoming our disciples. That isn't true. Government schooling is the most radical adventure in history. It kills the family by monopolizing the best times of childhood and by teaching disrespect for home and parents. Dot, dot, dot. He goes on in a lot greater detail.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's what this is about. That's what they're aiming at.
You know, when they did the DARE program, that was when our kids were... It definitely was when our kids were... I'm wondering if it was around when I was in school. I forget, they blend now, but it was definitely a turn in your parents thing. Do your parents a favor, you know, get them the help they need. Tell us when they're smoking marijuana, you know. How many lives were destroyed by the opinions of the collective? And it's not even really the collective. I have more faith in the opinion of the majority of Americans, or at least I used to, you know, than I do some government agent. You know, people, I think, act in their own self-interest, and even their collective interest. I think they're, you know, way smarter than what the vote totals say. So I don't believe it. I never did. That was what my activism started off being. I didn't believe the election process. And the more I scratched the surface, the more I found out I was right. So what is the driving force? Well, it's wallet voting. I mean, you know, it's people taking their time and treasure and putting it towards what they think is important. And that needs to be kids. And one thing, do you think, what are the forces that you think are bringing the birth rate down so much? Because we are going in decline in the population. I don't think that's healthy. I don't think it's good. I think it's intentional. I think there's a goal here. What do you think it is?
You know who agrees with you on that?
Elon
Musk. Your hero.
Yeah. You said it first. You brought
exactly.
it up. Oh, yeah, we got Starlink today, finally. And that's why you have been buffered a couple times a little bit. But it's been now I think we can stream a lot better. I can do the show from up here without freaking banging my head on the keyboard. Hit any key. Yeah, I'll hit a key. You know, the it has been
with every key.
Right. With a sledgehammer. We had I was showing James, you know, I'm going, all right, well, where's the instruction manual? This is the instruction manual. I love grandma adjust buttons like this. Put it up, plug it in, turn it on. I mean this is the instruction manual. And I go, thank goodness. That's a grandma, you know, adjust button right there. So it took about 15 minutes for it to set or whatever the hell it did. But other than that, and it hasn't been, oh, my God, speed. It's been like 90-something megabytes per second down and as high as like 30 up. I expected more, but it's a hell of a lot better than the onesie twosies that I had, you know.
Yeah.
So we'll probably keep it. Ugh. But, Elon said what that I agreed with?
About the overpopulation crisis being a hoax. No, it's the other way around. We're having an underpopulation crisis. People aren't having enough children. We're heading towards demographic crunch. I will just say that many, 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 many years before Elon was going around saying this, I was talking about it quite a bit. So actually use those keywords. Again, learning how to learn. Go to CorbettReport.com. There's a search bar in the sidebar where you can type in some of the keywords like demographic crunch or underpopulation. And you can find a lot of the work that I've done on this over the years. The overpopulation crisis is demonstrably, provably wrong. Even the United Nations, and with its population projections, shows that the overall global population is going to level off sometime around mid-century, and it's going to start to actually taper after that. So we're looking at an actual shrinking human population. Maybe, you know, the anti-humans in the crowd will rejoice. Yay! You know, oh, there's too many people ruining this planet. Well, no, we're looking at the potential extinction of the human species, and if you don't find that to be somewhat worrying, then I don't know what planet you're on.
Certainly
but
extinction
why?
Of entitlement payments to the older generation in this country. I guarantee that.
Exactly. This is an economic thing. You know, in a shrinking economy, when we're structured towards growth, how are you going to do this? Blah, blah, blah. Whatever the answer to that question is, we'll find out about it here in Japan before any of you guys, because we're already a shrinking population, an aging population, more adult diapers being sold than baby diapers, all of this stuff. I mean, it's already hitting here. Again, a point I've written about before, so people can find that in my archives. But the question is why? Why is this happening? Just in terms of the proximate cause, what is causing this to happen? The fact that population rates are plummeting. There are a number of different things about this, and I'm sure you've heard some of them before. For example, as countries industrialize and their economies develop, parents have fewer children. That is an established fact. It happens in every single country. That's just part of the sort of demographic calculations that parents make. But beyond that, there are scientific reasons and problems about what's happening right now. So I will point people back to my work on Paul Ehrlich, pseudoscience charlatan, CorbettReport.com/Ehrlich, Ehrlich, where you can learn about some of the other reasons why, for example, in the Western world, sperm counts, and I don't remember the exact dates on this, it's something from like the 1950s to the late 1990s or something like that, sperm plant counts plummeted something like 50% and have plummeted even further since then. Someone has written a book about that quite recently that I've talked about and recommended before. It's called Countdown, and I'm not going to remember her name off the top of my head, but if you look up, I believe, my previous summer reading list from 2021, you will find that book listed there, where she talks about some of the reasons for this, like phthalates, which are endocrine disrupting chemicals that are added and steeped in almost all of the manufactured plastic goo-gads and products that we get right now. They are doing a number on demonstrably fish species and others that are more receptive and more easily seen. These effects are more quickly seen. Like, you know, the meme, they're turning the frickin' frogs gay. Well, no, they're turning them hermaphroditic, actually. And there's, again, there's lots of research about this. This is a documented phenomenon. It sounded good, and it's so funny. Oh, that Alex Jones, he's so crazy. Well, actually, there's a real environmental problem here. But you're screaming your head off about people, you know, driving their car, whereas these endocrine-disrupting chemicals are disrupting, hey, if you're anti-human and you hate humans and you don't care about humans, okay, well, how about fish species and others that are showing demonstrable signs? The widespread environmental collapse is happening right now as a result of these chemical products, and people laugh at it because it's a funny meme.
Well, no, but just there's nonsense. You know, we always get, you know, Hollywood or get desensitized to it, or somebody kind of sneaks it in or whatever, and it certainly had a spark with me. It was the first, you know, modern Batman with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. And the whole point of that film was that he had, at the fundamental chemical base level of some, you know, cosmetics and industrial chemicals and so on, that if you, you know, had the right kind of hairspray combined with the right kind of perfume and deodorant, all of a sudden you die with a smile on your face. And, you know, would they poison us at a fundamental base chemical of a lot of cosmetics way? They wouldn't do that. That'd be wrong. I mean, you know, of course they would. And if it forwarded some agenda like sperm count, okay? So when you say they, because I've seen studies, you know, that are sperm count or mobility count, all this other stuff is going down. Fertility is going down. When we were having babies and stuff, I was surprised at how many families in our, you know, at our church and our Bible study age group, because they went by the age of the woman, you know, was having fertility problems. And I'm going, wow, at 20-something-year-old young women, you know, not being able to get pregnant and trying. So there's, and when you go from a birth rate, what's the replacement, 2.2 or something like that?
Something along that.
And, you know, we start going down to 1.8, 1.0, one, you know, below, and certainly Japan. You know, this, we saw this coming in Japan long time ago. Then you got more adult diapers sold than baby diapers. And that's a statistic that'll make you go, what the hell? You know, and so and then we get into, well, we need to have robots. Somebody's got to pick, you know, Grandpa Shinzo from the bed to the whatever. Oh, while I'm thinking about it, the Abe assassination, is there any new information on that? You're doing kind of a Corbettier open source report on something?
Yeah. To be honest, my inclination is that this probably was not some grand conspiracy. I haven't seen anything compelling.
I thought it was China.
It really does seem like a crazy. And I know there's a lot of people in the audience who will think, what? No, nothing ever just happens. Well, actually. But I'm willing to be, you know, convinced otherwise. But I haven't seen anything compelling. Just a lot of speculative, well, this could play into an agenda this way kind of stuff. But no, just show me the actual person who was, you know, secretly shooting him from somewhere else, or that it was all staged by actors.
No, that's not what I think what happened. Now, I don't know a damn thing. But he was pissed off at something, okay? You know, Abe did something to something and back, and I'm offended because of something. And, or paid or coerced or whatever. And, like, you go into Tom Cruise and Minority Report, and the guy that worked with the bad guys to kill and do whatever is because he was coerced into doing that and whatever.
Right.
Well, here, the FBI is always online trying to get some weak-minded person. They build them up. They get them all psyched up to do something. And I'm going, well, Japan wouldn't do that. That'd be wrong, you know. Well, yeah. Where'd they get their lesson from? So this could be a kind of something, and them do the same kind
question,
of crap.
The question is always, what is the reaction, right? It's always the wait 2 weeks, and we'll find out what this was about thing. So, it, you know, really? In the 2 weeks that we've been waiting, the story that has emerged about it is the Moonies, which is an actual political conspiracy that maybe people could be interested in, but it's not sexy enough. It's not like Klaus Schwab in the World Economic Forum secretly puppeteering assassins or something. No, it's the Moonies, who have some degree of political connection here in Japan. Weirdly enough, because it's a Korean organization that I think does not hold a lot of love for Japanese, but for some reason, Abe's grandfather really was involved in helping to establish the Moonies in Japan, and there are some weird connections there, and Abe has written congratulatory letters to Moony organizations and stuff. There are, and there was an interesting clip that I did see from Japanese TV, where they were talking to someone who was talking about, I think it was a journalist who had talked to police investigators about some of these connections in the past or something, and the police investigator said, well, we tried to pursue it, but there's too many political connections, you know, we can't take it any further. And it's like on this chat show kind of thing in Japan, and all the other guests and everyone just sort of shuts up, and then they're like, now let's go to commercials. Just immediately cut. Like,
okay,
you're not
going to
talk about that on TV.
So you speak Japanese well enough, you can follow a newscast.
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Well, you know, your impression, being English-speaking Canadian, covering American and world politics on the west coast of Japan, okay?
Yeah.
Is it propaganda? Is it more American style? Soviet style, East German style? What kind of style is it? Are they...
In a way, it's even more juvenile. It's one of those weird things where you would think the Japanese are all serious and everything, but their TV entertainment is just ridiculous. It's all chat show nonsense, and it's all, like, people reacting, like... I don't even know how to explain it. It is just nonsense.
YouTube,
I try to avoid it as much as possible.
Japanese,
there are the serious
YouTube
news channels, but no one watches them anyway, right? So it is propaganda, 1,000%. It's just not.
Well,
I don't think it quite looks like
it. Now
that
on the world
propaganda
stage with this Abe assassination, and you know, China going to Taiwan and wants Japan to be out of their way of blah 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 blah.
Yeah.
Are they world players? Have they been? Are they going to be? You know, is it, you know, when the world...
The Japanese?
Yeah,
or...
I'm wondering what role they're going to play. They used to be such an economic powerhouse.
Yeah, not anymore, huh? And that's part of what Abe was about. I'm going to change the economic system here, Abenomics and all of that, and it resulted in precisely nothing. So, honestly, Japan is a U.S. proxy in East Asia. That's the role that it served since the end of the Second World War. I'm sure that is the role it will continue to observe until the new World Order comes about, and who knows what happens then.
Well, what's their role in that?
Well, that's the question. Assuming that we are heading towards some sort of China Cold War, Hot War, whatever it is, there's a point at which you could imagine China will try to assert its influence over the East China Sea, the South China Sea, all of this. You know, where are they going to stop? And eventually that conflict hits here. And what was it? What happened recently? There was something about China conducting exercises that at any rate simulated attacking Japan or something. But there was something else specifically about that. But of course, Japan is on the list of target strikes for China in the event of some sort of war. Because, I think I'm thinking about the CNBC, or was it MSNBC, or one of those propaganda networks, did a simulation of war with China, where they simulated, well, what if China tried to take Taiwan and what would happen, blah, blah, blah. So they literally aired this as this propaganda thing. I did an article about it a few weeks ago if people want to read about it. You can watch the whole thing on YouTube if you want. But long and short of it, yeah, Japan quite quickly gets involved in what's going on there because, of course, they can't stay out of it given their situation. So Japan will have a part to play in all of this, and that was part of what Abe, one of his big pushes, was to reform the constitution, which – theoretically forbids Japan from being embroiled in any sort of military conflict, aggressive conflict anywhere in the world. And they want to reform that so that Japan can have a military, essentially. Japan already has one of the largest militaries on the planet. It's just not called a military. It's a self-defense force. It is a military. They just can't call it one. And they're constitutionally obligated not to actually send offensive forces around the world. So in the Iraq war, it was a big deal when they sent the self-defense forces over to Iraq to like dig trenches and things, not be involved in fighting, but just simply to help the U.S., you know, infrastructurally. That was a big deal and a big debate here. And now they're inching towards trying to make this into, well, we need a military to fight China.
Before you go, just answer this question. Do you think China is going to invade Taiwan?
You know, I'm more and more inclined to think that that is probably one of the tricks up the sleeve that will be part of this. As I've said for a long time now, I think towards this is the decade where at some point they're heading towards hot war. And even when that happens, I think one of the likely ways that will kick out, at least the one that they've been planning for and strategizing and thinking about and warning about and doing propaganda exercises about and all of this, is China trying to take Taiwan. And I was just reading a Brookings report from a couple of months ago about, well, maybe they won't try to physically, militarily try to take Taiwan, but maybe they'll just quarantine it, because Taiwan is officially, in their reading, it's China. It's not a foreign state. It is us. So we'll quarantine it and seal it off, and then,
like,
well, how does
the
U.S.
did to Cuba, you're not allowed to ship in and out kind of crap?
Exactly. And then what does the U.S. do? So, of course, now the U.S. is involved in their freedom of the seas, freedom of navigation exercises to send ships through the straits there and all of that. But, you know, and now Pelosi is going to Taiwan, which would be the first speaker in 25 years, I think, to do that, which China's already saying, don't do that. You're not going to want to do that. And now, so there's something kicking off there. So yeah, Taiwan is one of those issues that will come out of left field for a lot of people, because it's not being shoved in their face by the media, but I think it's definitely on the table.
There was a good libertarian friend that was a Southern Baptist minister in Winslow, Arizona. He was, in fact, Navajo County chairman of the Libertarian Party as a Southern Baptist pastor. And he went on mission for years in Taiwan. And we were talking a lot of time, going, man, what's the, you know, the rhetoric invasion? Oh, that'll never happen. That'll never happen. That'll never happen. But it got to where he got concerned enough. Now he's preaching in Oklahoma, you know. And I'm telling you, as bad as things are getting, and we have documented it, had a lot of stories on Freedom's Phoenix, have entire categories for a lot of this stuff, see it. And the closer it gets, the less and less I care. The less and less I'm concerned. The more and more I'm leaning towards the empowerment of the individual, you know, for them.
That's
to
the
be
only
able to survive.
Ultimate solution here, yeah.
And I'm thinking, and I'm getting to not just, you know, listeners and readers, that's becoming a common theme. And a lot of times, even when I was an activist and have a new neighbor or something, oh, what do you do? Then I, you know, talk about what we do. Oh, no, I just watch TV and when's the next game, don't care. And I go, when I grow up, I want to be like you. I mean, you know, you're not missing anything, you know?
No, you got to vote Trump. Come on. 2024, we can take it back, Ernie.
You know what I heard? Is that Trump and DeSantis are going to be a ticket. You know, that, you know, you don't have to pick between one or the
other. Sounds
you
plausible,
get both,
yeah.
You know? So I'm interested. Oh! Dr. Frank is at some medical conference in Spokane, which is a couple hours away. So he's coming up Saturday and Sunday here, you know? So we're going to do a show with Klaus from Germany, you know? Here, that's going to be fun, man. Entertainment.
Yeah. You know? I'll be listening.
Yeah, we'll make sure you want to listen to that one. That's going to be good, especially now that I can freaking stream and record decent.
Yeah, there you go.
Thanks for coming on. I always look forward to talking to you.
No problem.
We're on the right, same page of, it's going to be down to the actions of individuals and taking care of yourself and your family and your community. You know, so when it comes down to decentralization, whatever it is, the solution is going to be found there. I guarantee it.
Yep.
All right.
Yep, exactly.
Peace, brother.
All
Thanks for coming on.
Take care, man.
Talk to you later.
Thank you.